are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship the surround we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever, we're all swimming to the other side. I am alone, and I am searching, hungering for answers in my time. I am balanced on the brink of wisdom, I'm impatient to receive a sign. I move forward with my senses open, imperfection will be my cry. In humility I will listen, we're all swimming to the other side.
We are living beneath the great big, we are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever, we're all swimming to the other side.
On this journey through thoughts and feelings, finding intuition, my head, my heart, I am gathering the tools together, I am preparing to do my part. All of those who have come before me, band together and be my guide. Loving lessons that I will follow, we're all swimming to the other side.
We are living in the great big dipper, we are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever, we're all swimming to the other side. When we get there, we'll discover all of the gifts we were given to share have been with us since life's beginning, and we never noticed they were there. We can balance at the brink of wisdom, never recognizing that we've arrived. Loving spirits will live together, we're all swimming to the other side. We are living beneath the great big river, we are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever, we're all swimming to the other side. Loving spirits will live forever, we're all swimming to the other side.
And it's not on the program here because there was some late communication on my part, so my apologies for that. But if we can do a reading together, reading number 507. And we will read this in unison. Grant us the ability to find joy and strength, not in the strident call to arms, but in stretching out our arms, to grasp our fellow creatures in the striving for justice and truth. Thank you. So again, today, the works of Joseph Campbell has really been very inspirational to me. I've been very fascinated about religion for many, many years, and today we're going to be exploring his book, Occidental Mythology. So as I mentioned before, Occidental Mythology is mostly with the Western mythology, and I'll be looking at that. The divide between Occidental and Oriental mythology lies basically in Iran. And in the Oriental camp, the view is that the self and the being cannot be qualified. It transcends all thought, image, and definition. And to try to define God, man, nature, good, evil, or anything else falls short of the ultimate question. But what is precisely that enigma that defines who we are? That path to transcendence lies in who we are and in all things. The Indian Upanishad states that to know is to not to know, and to not to know is to know. Or as the Tao Te Ching said, those who know are still. In the Occidental myth, however, there are two basic players, God and man, and they are separate and distinct. The rituals and myth are designed to establish the divine relationship of God to man and man to God. In the European sphere of myth, gods were part of nature as well. They walked among us and followed the rules of nature. In the Levant, God was above nature and man and God made the God was above nature and man and God made the rules. It is important also to understand that not only in the Occidental myth does the spirit and the soul of the person continue onward after death. In just about all the myths of all the different religions in the Occident, the personality of that person continues after death and can also be brought back from the dead as well. In the Orient, the soul is reborn in the cycle of reincarnation, but is never the same. We first turn attention to the Bronze Age beginnings of religion in the Occident. In the ancient Sumerian myth and many others of the time, the view of the serpent has a very mystical nature. Its ability to shed its skin and be reborn, and because of this, its symbol is the waxing and waning moon, they are tied to mystical symbols of the times. And so it is also associated with the tides and also the rhythms of the womb. The natural symbology of the male phallus is apparent, but also the serpent as a swallower as well is associated with the female organ. So we again see the dual state of this creature. As is dual state, we routinely see it double twined. In the Mesopotamian myth, the dual serpent is wrapped around the axis mundi, or the world axis, while in the Sumerian myth, the Garden of Immortality, the caretakers of the garden were goddesses who are shown giving the boon of life from the Tree of Knowledge, wrapped by a dual serpent, to a mortal woman. And the symbol of the dual serpent can be seen this day in the medical symbol that we all know. We see in the Genesis myth of the garden that the serpent has been changed from a force of good to a corrupting servant of evil. It is common throughout these times to see these symbols of the old religions be attributed to those of the bad, that to all that is bad and and wrong, while elements of the new religion are only shown as good. And so it is common in the myth of the Levant and the European worlds to see a shining hero go forth to conquer an evil serpent that is defending its hoard, be it a treasure or a maiden to be rescued or a prized relic to save all of mankind. And all of these myths and stories of the new religions can be seen as an example of defeat of the Mother Earth goddess worshippers of the old. Another common theme in the ancient religions is that of the twin goddesses and the child king. In the Sumerian myth, the twin goddesses of Inanna, the goddess of the heavens, and Erechishal, the goddess of the underworld. Along with them is her son, Dumuzi. These same figures were translated into the Greek myth of Aphrodite and Persephone, along with the god Adonis. It was also seen as Demeter and Persephone, along with their foster child, Triptolemus, who brought grain to mankind. The twin goddess motif is centered around the duality of life, the yin and yang, the birth and rebirth, and is almost always the god, the child, is the god of the dead and the resurrecting king. This duality is carried throughout all religions going forward, and we shall explore this a little bit later on as well. As the ancient religions shifted from a pure matriarchal base to a patriarchal base, the twin goddesses changed to a father-mother-child relationship. In the Babylonian religion, there is a story of the father, Apsu, the mother, Tiamat, and their son, Mumu, or as the Greek counterparts of Uranus, Gaia, and their children, the Titans. In both cases, the mother goddess gave birth to the other gods, and they rose up in revolt against their predecessors. For Tiamat, as the Mother Earth goddess, she also gave birth to a whole assortment of monsters and serpents to battle against the leader of the gods, Marduk. In the end, like the Greek gods, they were able to trick the mother goddess and achieve victory. Out of this battle, Marduk fashioned the race of man from the blood and bones of the losing side, those of Tiamat, and thus entered the race of man into servitude of the gods and to the gods. And so, with religions adapting and introducing elements of the defeated or enemy religion into their own as negative elements, we can also see that in Genesis, Tiamat is reintroduced as the snake in the garden. The etymology of the word Tiamat is also related to the Hebrew word Tehom, which means the deep. And that Ea conquered Apsu and Merodach conquered Tiamat, Zeus the serpent, son of Gaia. And so we also see that Yahweh conquered the sea monsters of Rahab and the Leviathan. But this biblical work is really the end translation of myth after going through many iterations throughout the years, and as follows. It started out with the world being born of a goddess without a consort. Later, it evolved into a world being born of a goddess conceived by a consort. It then transformed into a world being fashioned by the body of a goddess by a male warrior god. And lastly, the ultimate achievement, for lack of a better word, was the world being created unaided by the power of a male god alone. As we know from studying myth and stories of the past, all is originally seen as a story of the mother goddess giving tasks to her son, which is her agent. But as time passes and the stories gain a patriarchal twist to them, the female principle is devalued along with this point of view, so that in the end, all that was once good and cherished is now seen as negative, a demoness dangerous and fierce. And this mother goddess of the world has remained an ever-present threat to the patriarchal castle of reason, which they assume to be dead but is actually alive and is threatening to shift. Joseph Campbell now turns attention to the heroes of the Levant and the gods of the Levant from about 1500 to about 500 BC. It is interesting that he opens this section with the following passage. The world is full of origin myths, and all are factually false. The world is full also of great traditional books tracing the history of man from the age of mythological beginnings through periods of increasing plausibility to a time almost within memory when the chronicles begin to carry the record to the present. Furthermore, just as all primitive mythologies serve to validate their customs, the systems of settlements and political aims of their respective local groups, so do these great traditional books. On the surface, they may appear to be composed of conscientious history. In depth, they reveal themselves to be conceived as myth, poetic readings of the mystery of life from a certain interested point of view. But to read a poem as a chronicle of fact, to say the least, is to miss the point. To say a little more is to prove oneself a dolt. Those are his words. And to add to this, the men who put these books together were not dolts, but knew precisely what they were doing, as evidenced by their manner of work reveals at every turn. In the Jewish religion, it has been discovered over the years that, first of all, that the Book of Law was found by the priest Hilkiah, in the year 621 BC during the repair of Solomon's temple, and was found basically the nucleus of the Book of Deuteronomy. Much of the earlier works of the Old Testament were reworked to fit this find, and lastly, that the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers that were attributed to Moses during his years in the desert were actually the end product of hundreds of years of refinement and brought to Jerusalem from Babylon and established as binding rules for all Jews by the Persian Emperor Artaxerxes. Sorry, some of these old names are kind of hard to pronounce. The books of the Old Testament, therefore, have two versions. One is the Elohim text, and one is the Yahweh text. The Elohim is the newer text, and the Yahweh is more of the older text. So within this light, we look upon all the myths of the Levant as a migration from one to the other, not as separate and distinct. One need only compare the birth of Moses with the Mesopotamian myth of the birth of King Sargon, which states, "My mother was of lowly birth, my father I knew not. The brother of my father was a mountain dweller. My lowly mother conceived me and bore me in secrecy. She placed me in a basket of rushes, sealed it with a bitumen, and sent me on the river, which, however, did not engulf me. The river bore me up, and it carried me to Aku, the irrigator, who took me from the river, raised me as his son, made me a gardener, and while I was a gardener, Ishtar loved me." So you can definitely see a lot of parallel there. You can also see kind of the motif of the virgin birth, which is also attributed to Moses as well. We always know his mother, but never his father. Also with Moses in the story of Exodus, we see the whole Jewish people having descended into the underworld, being Egypt, and having escaped through the Red Sea and were born as the chosen people of God. This is unique here in the Jewish tradition that the hero of the passage is the whole people, not a single person, not even Moses. In the Sumer myth, the resurrection of the god Adonis happened at exactly the same time as Passover and was celebrated in the Jewish faith in 621 BC after finding the lost document, as mentioned earlier. Later, this date still is celebrated as a day of Easter in Christian faith, but it's important to note again that the resurrected god is the chosen people, and this is cemented in the Jewish tradition where we have in the official Occidental worship that there must be 10 or more adult men to be present for an official worship to happen. The individual doesn't really matter. The relationship to God is through the chosen people, and the body of the chosen people is the only living thing that is holy on earth. Compare this to the Indian way of personal enlightenment through yoga, or the Chinese way through Tao, or with the Occidental personal divinity of Adonis, Dionysus, or Christ. We now move to the Greek myth and the age of their great gods and heroes, around the same time, about 1500 BC to about 500 BC. What is nice about Greek mythology is that we don't have to debate whether this is viewed as myth or historical religion. The Greeks always knew that their gods were myth. Earlier, it was mentioned that Tiamat in the Babylonian myth was a goddess of the world and mother of the gods and serpents and beasts. In the Greek myth, she is symbolized by Gaia, the mother earth, and gave birth to the titans and other creatures, including the Medusa. Like before, the Medusa with her serpent hair can be seen as Tiamat herself, and the slaying of the Medusa by Perseus is again symbolic of the defeat of the old religion by the new. Also, we know that Zeus, able to shapeshift into many forms to fulfill his urges, and Semitic conquests of Zeus were almost always reinterpreted goddesses from other religions that the Greeks were in contact with and contest with, be it the Cretes, the Egyptians, the Macedonians, whoever. Many Greek theologians at the time were actually a little bit revolted by having to write all of Zeus's conquests into their mythology and having to try to find all these different pieces to fit in for Zeus to conquest, depending on their conflicts with other religions around the world. And that sometimes people can think that the underlying revulsion helped ease a transition away from their religion and onto others, like Christianity, when it was first introduced. The Medusa is also always depicted in a squatting position with her tongue over her chin, arms raised, which is exactly how the primitive religion of the Melanesia depicted their guardian of the other world. In the Greek myth, she is in a cave leading to the underworld, the road of which is also leads to the golden apple tree. And this is exactly the same myth as Gilgamesh and his encounter with Siduri. We can also compare the story of the Greek hero Hippolytus, who is dragged to his death behind his chariot of horses, only to be revived by Diana to serve as her consort and king, with a Christian Saint Hippolytus, who is dragged to his death by horses on August 13th, which is also coincidentally, not a coincidence at all, which is Diana's holy day. So there's a lot of transcendence and overlap of religions and picking up of thoughts from one to the other. In the Hellenistic times, there is also a migration to a more patriarchal order, as mentioned earlier. The power of heroes and gods being born of the power of the word versus the birth of the womb is clearly shown in this transition. The birth of Athena from the head of Zeus is but one example of this. And with this, we can also see a few other traits being picked up in religion here at this time, especially as the trend continued. First, that spiritual creation starts not with the womb, but with the brain. And because of this, spirituality and sexuality were very much opposed. Secondly, the function of the female is significantly reduced, more to the point of being an object of conquest instead of being the object of reverence. Women are being more judged by their beauty, like Aphrodite, consonance with keeping their marriage and keeping their marriage bed, like Hera, or inspiring heroes to do great patriarchal deeds, like Athena. It is also important now to state that the fundamental difference here between the Levant and Hellenistic points of view to religion. In the Levant, God created not only man, but also all the laws of land for man to follow. God created the world, but was not bound to it. He was above it. In the Greek and Hellenistic world, the gods shared the land with man and were bound by its same laws. Man created the laws, so for the Levant, the way to God was to study the Bible, Torah, or Quran, and let the pagans worship the moon. Also, as mentioned earlier, in the Levant, the texts were seen as true historical work. Therefore, to deviate from the religious fact that all laws are divinely set is to turn away from God. We turn our attention now to the probably the most overlooked religion, and is fundamentally for the foundation of all religions, be it action and symbolism, in almost all of the Levant, which is Zoroastrianism. Founded in Persia by the prophet Zoroaster, in 1200 BC, this centered around the worship of the god of truth, Ahura Mazda. Themes of the religion can be heard in Greek, Latin, Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic, and every other language in the West. In this religion, the world itself is corrupt, not by nature, but by accident, and is the responsibility of man to reform the world by human action. Wisdom, virtue, and truth were achieved through engagement, not disengagement. Ahura Mazda wasn't the old god of the religion, though. Well, sorry, wasn't the only god of this religion, though. He also had his antagonist, Angra Minyu, the demon of the lie, who has corrupted every particle of the world which it was created. But Angra Minyu wasn't eternal like Ahura Mazda. He could be defeated when truth, light, and wisdom prevailed. These two gods also had archangel servants, known as the benevolent Amisha Septas and the malignant Devas. The Christian order of angels and devils came from this order as well. Here, too, we can also see that the halo shown around saints today deriving from the halo around the Zoroastrian angels. The principal tenet of Zoroastrianism is not just to follow the religion in thought, but also in acts and deeds. Once he finds a cause, he must cleave to it as intently as possible. Individuality is also heavily stressed. One should not follow rote and command like a herding beast, but act like a man with a mind. A great quote from the prophet is, "Well is he who has caused his own benefit to become the benefit of another." So they're really looking for personal involvement, growing yourself, and helping others as well. So it's a kind of a nice little idea there. The important difference of Zoroastrianism versus Judeo-Christian belief, though, is that evil preceded man, while in Genesis states that evil is caused by the fall of man from Eden. For in the Judeo-Christian belief, if God is the creator of all and must be absolutely perfect and harmonious, then God creates evil because of evil people and for evil people. Therefore, evil will end, all evil will end, when mankind is able to root out all evil acts. But from the Zoroastrianism view, evil will always be in the world that was created by Angra Minyu. And the path to destroy evil is a personal quest to rid evil within. Also, corruption comes in the form of a lie, which in the biblical sense, corruption of fall from grace is due to disobedience. A great deal of emphasis is placed in the Bible on obedience on some arbitrary taboos, like food, Sabbath laws, circumcision, and other things. The first main Persian king to embrace Zoroastrianism, was Cyrus the Great. And the Persian emperor grew in height and power and culminated with King Darius at about 525 BC. The kingdom stretched from the Nile to the Caspian Sea and all the way up into southeastern Europe. When Alexander invaded Persia from 336 to 330 BC, he gave strict orders that no sacred object should be injured. But just two centuries earlier, King Darius commanded the exact opposite when invading parts of Greece. Thus, it is fitting that in true Levant fashion, where Ahura Mazda was the one true god, and after Darius passed, that his son Xerxes tried to invade Greece. For all those that have seen the movie 300, we know that his army and fleet were either turned away or defeated by a much smaller Greek army and navy. And that was to mark the boundary of the Zoroastrian expansion. The Persian kingdom was further eroded with the ascent of the Roman Empire. A little fun story first about the founders of Rome, Romulus and Remus. It is said that they were both born of a virgin birth to a Vestal virgin. They were born both very large and very handsome, and their father took them away from his Vestal daughter to prevent scandal. He gave the twins to a servant to be cast away, and he put them in a bow by the edge of a river. Sounds kind of familiar like the Moses myth too, doesn't it? The river rose and carried them away, very similar to the story of Perseus and his mother being drowned by their father, landing on an island, and they were raised by a she-wolf and fed by woodpeckers. Gotta love myth. Both these creatures were animals of Mars, and so it lends to the myth that their father was Mars himself, and so they are of divine birth. Later in adulthood, Romulus rescued his brother from the tyrant king and also freed his mother and set off to build a city on the place where they were raised. But the exact spot where they could build the city, they left to divination, and when they disagreed about the mystic symbols, they came to blows and Remus was killed. Later, after Rome had been founded and grown in size, Romulus didn't exactly pass away, but instead he just disappeared. And so it is no secret that back then he was despised by the Senate, and many thought that he was murdered by members of the Senate. But the Senate also told the people that they should worship him since he was taken up by the gods. Later, a friend of Romulus made an oath to the Forum that he had met Romulus on the road with flaming, shining armor and looked taller and more handsome than ever before. When asked why he had left, Romulus is said to have answered, "It pleased the gods that we, who came from them, should remain so long a time amongst men as we did, and having built a city to be the greatest in the world of empire and glory, should again return to heaven." It should be compared with the story of Luke chapter 24, where on the third day after his crucifixion, Luke and Cleopas but did not recognize Christ on the road to Jerusalem, and they were asked what they were discussing. They recounted the story of the death of Jesus and that his body wasn't found that morning by some of the women. Jesus responded by saying that it wasn't necessary, that wasn't it necessary for him to suffer all that he had to enter into his glory? He then recounted all the stories of earlier prophets recounting his coming. And as they drew to their house, it appeared that Christ meant to take the road further along, and they begged him to stay with them for the evening because it was getting late and the day was drawing to a close. So he went in and broke bread with them. And after they finished saying their prayers and received the bread, Christ had disappeared as they suddenly recognized him. So you can see the same similar story as well, carried from the Roman and founding of Rome to the story of Christ after the crucifixion. In continuing with the Romulus story, it is said that divine beings are not bound to the earth, and when freed of the mortal vessel, all is returned to the heavens to be with the gods. So again, we can see the parallel between that and Christ's resurrection. Many aspects of the birth and death of Christ can also be seen in parallel roots to either Zoroastrianism or Egyptian roots. The angelic host speaking to the shepherds is very similar to the story of the birth of Zoroaster, and the angelic host shining with a light on the halo is also how Ahura Mazda is depicted. The visit of the Magi is said to have happened on January 6th, which is exactly the same day as the rising star appears over the River Nile, signifying the rise of the waters of life and tribute that made to the death and resurrecting god Osiris. December 25th, which was Sol Invictus Day for the Romans, and was also the birth of Mithra, in the Persian world. In fact, December 25th wasn't even recognized as Jesus' birthday until the Council of Nicaea in 354 AD. So, baptism was first recorded in the Sumerian religion with the worship to the water god Ea, whose symbol was Capricorn, depicted as part goat and part fish, and is a sign in which the sun enters the winter solstice for rebirth. Ea has been called also Onus, which in Greek is called Ionis, or Latin, Johannes, or Hebrew, Johanan, and in English, John. So some feel that there was actually never a Jesus or a John, but instead there was a water god and a sun god. Kind of fascinating. In this time across the Mediterranean region, and even out into India, as I stated last sermon when I talked about Oriental mythology, there are also many religions all intermixing with one another as trade and war spread new ideas across the world. These religions all had many similar themes, so it should be no surprise that A, first of all, that these religions were ripe for reception to the gospel of Christianity, and then also B, that Christianity should be ripe for contamination within the pagan religions as well. Many words that are attributed to Jesus can actually be found in many of these common stock sayings of the time. The editors of the gospel, according to Mark, Matthew, and Luke, in that order, around 75 to 90 AD, drew on these accounts and added them to these works in their own separate and often contradictory accounts. With the gospel according to Paul, Christianity takes another interesting turn. Paul stated that, "Be imitators of me, as I am Christ." With this, what he's really saying is that no one should conceive or follow his own image of Christ, as stated in the Acts of John, but that only of Paul and his community. And within this community, Christianity matured, and the history of the West was shaped for the next 2,000 years. But still, when Christ was having his first teachings, it was largely seen as one to prepare mankind for the coming of the apocalypse, which was seen to be happening imminently. Naturally, this did not happen, and his message also got distorted to fit over the years. But as you know, it really wasn't until the Emperor Constantine came into power and saw a cross of light over a battlefield that he converted and made Christianity the sole religion of the Roman Empire. The day of worship was also moved to Sunday to correspond with Apollo, the sun god. And with this, the collection of treasures and relics attributed to other saints and more important people had a very significant attraction and was more attractive than even gold. So it's not surprising that new saints and new objects of worship were venerated out of nothingness. In 453 AD, barbarians then came from the north and poured into Rome, and the empire was significantly reduced. This time, too, there were attacks from the east by Attila the Hun, Vandals and Visigoths as they poured into Spain and North Africa, the Saxon Jutes and Angles poured into England from Germany, and the Franks settled into Gaul. Balance didn't start to be restored until Christmas Day in the year 800 when the Emperor Constantine pulled on the solar crown, the symbol of Ahura Mazda, and that was handed to him by Pope Leo III. So it's very interesting that the symbol, the crown for the emperor is also carried over from Zoroastrianism. To further add to the confusion and direction of the church at this time, there are many different councils to determine Christ's divinity and the direction of the church. The first and most famous was, of course, the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. But there was another one in 431 that was summoned by Theodosius II, and another one called in 450, not in Rome, but in Constantinople. This meeting drew about 100 different bishops from the Levantine cities, but only about a half dozen from the Western cities. This caused a split in the church, with the emperor's chosen leader sitting in Constantinople and the head of Peter's church still sitting in Rome. The direction of the church at this point was a lot more political. Learning and faith both held political value and were pursued to assist the state, not just for personal knowledge. The last and sixth council was held in 680 AD, but nothing was really agreed upon in that council, because at that same time, there was a new shout being heard across the Levant and the West. And this is the Islamic proclamation that there is no God but God. In Islam, it is believed that Abraham and Ishmael, Abraham's son from the handmaiden, built the Kaaba in the Great Mosque of Mecca, and it's also that Muhammad is descended from Ishmael. At Mecca, there is a perfectly rectangular stone known as the Kaaba, and is said to hold the image of the patron god Habul, as well as other sacred artifacts. This was later said to be given to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. Mecca was a major trading point, and the Kaaba was already known around the world as places of draw and worship by all that were there before Muhammad's time. And there was also an annual festival there. So there were many different thoughts and ideas crossing that area at the time when Muhammad was born. It is also said that his wife, Waraka, was also a Christian. Muhammad first started to look down to convert his family and friends, and later brought his message to many others that were around to gather in Mecca. As his followers grew, he started to mandate that they eliminate all pagan images from their sanctuary and to recognize their deity as the only one God of man. But all this was instigation naturally caused many others in this very cosmopolitan city to be upset with this new sect, and they looked to drive him out of Mecca, and they moved him across the Red Sea. Muhammad continued to build followers and refine his message. During his lifetime, he had two daughters, but he had no sons. When he passed 23 years after first hearing the voice of God, the argument of who would take over as a head of Islam was a matter of great debate, and often settled by murder. His chief companion at the time was Omar, who took over the reins and led a bloody war to all that opposed them and expanded the influence of Islam. After 7 years of a very successful war, he was slain by a slave as he slept. Muawiyah bin Abdul Sufyan was appointed by Omar to control Syria, and he battled Ali, Muhammad's cousin, for control of the caliphate. Ali was slain in battle, and his eldest son continued the battle. He fell 8 years later, and then his brother Hussein took over. When Hussein fell in battle on October 10th, 680 AD, this date became to the Shia the Good Friday for them, and Shia itself means the followers of Ali. The schism between Shia and Sunni exists to this day. They feel that as Muhammad's cousin, the prophetic knowledge was passed down through the family and later from Iman to Iman. They believe that the spiritual authority is not held in the consensus, or the ijma, but is actually held within the Iman, who has absolute to whom absolute submission is required. Laws of other biblical texts were built up and into practice by many hundreds of years and blended into society. But with Islam, all the word of God came from a single person only over a 23-year span. It is almost impossible to formulate a full society and legal structure upon that. And therefore, when Muhammad died, there were three controls that were set up for all to follow. The first, obviously, was the Quran itself. If it wasn't found in the Quran as something for people to follow and take judgment on, then the next was a selection of anecdotes and statements that were largely accepted by all and largely associated with Muhammad's immediate companions. These were called the Hadith, which were largely complete within a 200 to 300 year span. If an issue couldn't be resolved either by these two points, then decisions were determined by analogy or qiyas, which were basically tried to adhere the new problem based on the underlying principles of the Quran and the Hadith. Because these three because the principles in these three controls were built up to be immutable, then all law and practice in this society was also immutable and divinely inspired. The right of interpretation of Islam, called the ijtihad, slowly was reduced more and more over the centuries, to the point that the doctors of Islam proclaimed that the ijtihad has closed once for all and for all, and no one could proclaim to have the right to open it. So a person can still have counsel and have a sensible human experience, but only if that person kept their counsel exclusively to themselves. An individual in Islam is basically cut down to almost nothing. The following of the counsel of consensus by the group is absolute paramount. Part of this is spelled out in a twist of the creation myth that we all know in Genesis. In the Garden of Eden, this is from the Quran, God tells all his angels to bow down to Adam. All do, except for Satan. He remembers God's primary law that only he should be worshipped. It can be said that because Satan loved God so much and didn't conform to the rest of the angels was the reason that he was cast down to hell. Disobedience, the exercise of individual thought and action, was the worst crime of all. Before I conclude, I also want to worth noting that religions of all types are divided into regional or tribal religions and also world religions. Greek and Jewish religions shall be seen as the former, the more tribal, while Christianity, Buddhism, and Islam are the three main world religions that we have now. Judaism, as we have seen, divine grace is only given to the chosen people. With the world religions, enlightenment or salvation is provided through following the word or path of the prophet, teacher, or the man-god, like Jesus. So in conclusion, we can see an evolution of the mystic thought over the years, sometimes uplifting, and others not so much. We can see a tie of social and political order with the mystic thought that within the Levantine societies, they tend to see their call and the origin from a historical viewpoint. God is above and beyond the world, and the path to God in heavens lies only slightly differently. Within the Hellenistic world, all are here because of the Mother Earth goddess and are bound by the laws of nature too. Love of nature, music, art, law, self, and others is also one of the central tenets of these Hellenistic societies. But all religion is known as myth and only myth. But because of this, but this isn't necessarily a bad thing. As Joseph Campbell states, one of the main functions of mythology is to initiate the individual into the realities of his own psyche, guiding him towards his own spiritual enrichment and realization. So that's it. Thank you.